Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. This is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Gray is one of the most accomplished sportscasters in history. He's covered nearly every significant sporting event in the world, including the Olympics, Super Bowls, boxing title fights, and World Series. His career spans over four decades, and his trophy cabinet includes 12 Emmy Awards. During that time, Jim has had the honor of interviewing some of the greatest and most iconic athletes ever, including Michael Jordan, Michael Phelps, Tiger Woods, and Tom Brady. You can't rack up that kind of resume without having some stories to share. Luckily for us, Jim does in his memoir, Talking to Goats. In the book, Jim reflects back on some of the highlights of his broadcasting career. He also details the lowlights and some of the infamous and bizarre sports events he was a part of. We zoomed in with Jim from his LA home to talk about some of these moments, what he regrets, what he doesn't, and who he considers to be the GOAT interview.
Well, it's got to be Muhammad Ali. He invented it. He created it. And he was just so much fun and so creative. And, you know, he's beyond legendary and iconic. His name will withstand the test of time, what he stood for in the ring and achieved, and what he stood for outside of the ring and the principles and everything that went on in his life. That's why his name's on top.
There you go. Yeah. The late comedian Gary Shandling said that you should have a TV show called I Can Make You Hit Me. What did he mean by that?
Well, I guess he felt that I asked penetrating questions. You know, at times were possibly uncomfortable for some folks that, you know, in trying to ascertain that information, perhaps somebody might want to hit me. Never happened.
Never happened. No,
I mean,
no.
Much to Gary's chagrin, he was a dear friend and I miss him.
Take us back to Saturday, June 28th, 1997, the boxing match that was originally billed as The Sound and the Fury, but was retroactively referred to as the Bite Fight. It was the WBA heavyweight championship between Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield.
Well, it was a much anticipated rematch because Holyfield had unexpectedly, at least to the public, not to him, beaten Tyson in that fight. And so this was going to be the revenge that Mike was going to be able to enact and extract. Based on having lost that fight that, you know, was considered a huge upset at that time. So there was a lot of anticipation for it. There was a lot of, you know, it was a worldwide huge spectacle.
The waiting is over. The talking is done. The rematch is here. Evander Holyfield, confident, relaxed. Mike Tyson predicting a sensational victory. The sense of anticipation as before the first fight is almost palpable. Here we go, fight two, round one.
That's what Mike Tyson brought to the ring. It was a train wreck that everybody had to see, but nobody had ever suggested or would have even thought that he would bite off another man's earlobe.
A very angry Evander Holyfield now. A left hook.
You know, it's funny, Mike was having his best round.
He did it again. Mike Tyson has bitten Evander Holyfield for the second time, and it is all out war.
I saw that one. That was right clear. It's a miracle he didn't get bit back.
I'll tell you what, this is unbelievable.
It was something we hadn't seen before. It is something we had not seen since. And it is highly unlikely that there will be anything quite like that again, particularly by somebody who was the youngest heavyweight champion of all time in a rematch for the title.
Let's go over to Jim Gray.
All right, thank you very much, Steve Albert. Steve, thank you very much. I have Mills Lane. Mills, why did you stop the fight? Because of the first bite on the ear or the second?
The second one. The first one was a foul. I took 2 points. Said he could continue.
And in the midst of this brouhaha, you finally got a chance to interview Mike Tyson. Can you give us a blow-by-blow account, no pun intended, of that interview?
Well, Tyson, the referee Mills Lane stopped the fight. So the sheriff's department and the police got in the ring, and it was chaos, and they finally got him out of the ring, and, you know, all kinds of debris being thrown at him, and, you know, chaos in the ring and outside and with the crowd. Went back into his locker room. So he was extremely agitated still, and still, you know, he's a fighter, and he still had all this pent-up energy and wanted to fight. And so he answered the questions.
I got to retaliate.
Now, immediately, you stopped. You stopped fighting immediately right there, and you turned to Mills Lane, and you said what? And the result was he did nothing. But what did you say to Mills right at that time?
I don't remember what I said. I told him that he butted me, but I know I complained about being butted. And we complained about the first fight. Listen, Holyfield's not the tough warrior everyone said he is. He got little nicks on his ear and he quit. I got one eye. He's not impaired. He got ears. I got one eye. Big deal. If he take one, I got another one. I'm ready to fight. He didn't want to fight. I'm ready to fight him right now.
Mills Lane stopped the fight. It wasn't Holyfield who stopped
him. Oh, he didn't want to fight.
Let me ask.
We don't know what Mills did. Don't put nothing on Mills.
I've always admired and respected Mike because, unlike so many people who do things wrong, and this was a despicable, heinous act, okay? It was awful. He had the wherewithal, and he came out and he answered the questions. He didn't hide behind a press release or a PR team or a lawyer or go hide under a desk for 8 days and hope that it would go away and then, you know, just have the public move on and never say anything. He came out and he answered the questions, and he always did, and he always does. You know, he takes his own medicine. And how many people are accountable and responsible for their own actions? And like he said, nobody was going to take my glory. And even if it wasn't glorious, he created it and he was going to stand with it.
As you say in your book, it's hard to put honest and biting someone's ear off in the same description, but that was Tyson.
Absolutely. He's one of the last honest athletes, right? He will tell you what is on his mind and what he is thinking, and he will do it without any reservation or trying to spin. He's not trying to curry favor. He will tell you exactly what it is. Now, you may not like that, and you may not agree with it, but he does it.
The Tyson bite fight, this would not be your last bizarre sporting event. You were involved in perhaps the strangest and most chaotic sporting event ever on November 19th, 2004. It was an NBA game between the Indiana Pacers and the Detroit Pistons at the Palace of Auburn Hills in Michigan. It would forever be known as the Malice at the Palace. Can you take us back to that night and tell us what happened?
Well, that was you know, one of those very unforeseen circumstances. That was something that, you know, the game was basically over. The Pacers were going to win the game. There was a little skirmish out on the court, a hard foul, bit of an altercation that transpired between Ben Wallace and Ron Artest.
Ben Wallace was fouled, and Wallace did. Oh, Wallace, right at Artest. This has potential to be serious if they don't get between. Wallace upset. Spurs trying to hold each other off.
And Artest tried to walk away after the hard foul, and he went over and laid down on the scorer's table and tried to defuse it and had a moment of zen. And all of a sudden, a cup full of suds came flying through and hit Artest, and that set off the volatility. And he had a natural reaction, really. It was a human reaction to want to respond to that. Problem is, you can't do that.
Now Artest has jumped over the scorer's table and is trying to get down to the bench. Artest is in the stands. Oh, this is awful. Fans are getting involved. Steven Jackson's in the fans. Rasheed Wallace going into the stands.
You can't be an NBA player and go in the stands and beat up the very customers who are paying for your game. And then if you do, if you make that decision, you better hit the right guy. You better find the guy who did it. And that wasn't the case. And then Steven Jackson, who everybody thinks is going in to try and stop the fight, makes matters worse because he goes in and starts fighting with another fan as opposed to dragging Artest out. And it just kind of went downhill after that. So it was a horrible moment for the NBA, terrible moment for the Pistons and the Pacers. And the Pacers franchise was set back really for a very, very long time because of it.
The one interview that you probably received the most criticism for was your interview with Pete Rose during the 1999 World Series. There was a celebration of baseball's all-century team before the game. Why was this interview with Pete Rose so significant?
Well, he was voted onto the field by MasterCard. In other words, a credit card company had taken over the voting and had paid a fee to Major League Baseball. Baseball had banished Pete Rose, so they had given up control of the very ceremony that they were now having for the all-century team. And when the fans voted him on, baseball couldn't take that away because they didn't control it. So they had no choice but to go ahead with it. And when they did, the fans basically were saying, "This is your time, Pete. We will honor you with this award and putting you on this team in substitute because you're not going to get into the Hall of Fame." So it was actually his Hall of Fame moment, and he got a rousing ovation. the significance of it was he hadn't been on the field for 10 years since signing away his own banishment from the game of baseball for betting on baseball, and having there have been significant amounts of evidence that was found by John Dowd in the Dowd report and turned over to the commissioner of baseball, Bart Giamatti, and then later after he passed away to Faye Vincent. So there was this warm, wonderful, melancholy feeling of seeing Ted Williams up there and Sandy Koufax and Willie Mays and Stan Musial and Frank Robinson and all of these great players. And then all of a sudden, boom, NBC and I conducting this interview on NBC, come on and we start talking about gambling. So there was an abrupt change of tone and timing from the beautiful symbols and warm feeling that everybody is having about their childhood and seeing all their heroes and a great feeling about baseball to Pete Rose and his gambling.
Pete, those who will hear this tonight will say that you have been your own worst enemy and continue to be. How do you respond to that?
What way are you talking about?
By not acknowledging what seems to be overwhelming evidence.
Yeah, I'm surprised you're bombarding me like this. I mean, I'm doing an interview with you on a great night, a great occasion, a great ovation. Everybody seems to be in a good mood. And you're bringing up something that happened 10 years ago.
Well, I bring it up because I think people would like to see you get it on. See, we got to go. We got to game.
Prosecutor's brief. It's not an interview. And I'm very surprised at you. I am, really.
Well, some would be surprised that you didn't take the opportunity. Let's go upstairs and have it. Congratulations.
It became very controversial. There was a tremendous amount of blowback and tumult and agita. For me, the reverberations of that interview struck a chord with a number of fans.
The man of the hour is with Jim Gray.
Thank you very much, Bob. Chad, tell us about that pitch.
I can't do it. You know, as a team, we kind of decided that, you know, we because of what happened with Pete, we're not going to talk out here on the field. I do want to say that was for you, though, Grandma. Thanks.
Well, Chad, you don't want to talk about the home run? All right, Bob. Back upstairs to you.
All right, Jim. Yeah, but this was a scary time for you in the wake of the interview because there was a lot of negative feedback. You even received a lot of death threats. I'm curious, did this experience make you doubt yourself and consider changing the way you approached your interviews? I'm thinking no, but I'm curious.
Well, it's a horrible experience and a horrible feeling to have all of that going on. Did I doubt myself in that interview? No. It didn't cause me to, you know, change the way that you ask questions. You have to ask questions to ascertain information, but it does cause you to revisit, you know, that you're having the same experience everybody else is, because it would have changed if I'd have been watching television.
Let's talk about the decision, which was broadcast live on ESPN on July 8th, 2010.
The answer to the question everybody wants to know. LeBron, what's your decision?
In this fall, man, this is very tough. In this fall, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach and join the Miami Heat.
Miami Heat.
Were you and LeBron happy with how it went?
You know, obviously it was a very difficult decision for him. And he is, you know, you could tell he was nervous, and he has subsequently said it was one of the most nervous moments of his life and had to be very difficult decision. He's from the Cleveland area in Akron. And so, yeah, you know, when you say happy, I didn't detect any unhappiness. I detected some uneasiness. It's not easy to leave the place you're from.
Yeah. A decade later, you now compare LeBron to former MLB-er Curt Flood, who all but created free agency in sports. What do you think is the lasting legacy of the decision?
Well, Curt Flood challenged the reserve clause, and he lost, but he ended up paving the way for true free agency in baseball. It was player freedom. And this, in the same way, all those years later, did the same thing for players in the NBA. The formation of where they wanted to go and self-determination, how they wanted to do it, with who they wanted to do it with. And while there had been super teams in the NBA before, they were never, ever set up by players. He took all of the risk, and he was villainized for it. That was miscast. That was wrong. And we did a television show which generated millions and millions of dollars for the Boys and Girls Clubs, the biggest donation that's ever been made in the history of that organization. Should have been explained better. And we could have been more sensitive to the fans in Cleveland. It had to be very difficult to love the Cavaliers and to love your city and state and to be hearing that the best player in the game is leaving a place that he's from. But it also was the birth not only of this player freedom and self-determination, but social media and how players communicate. And look at the rise now in Twitter and the Players Tribune. We now spend the majority of each season wondering who this class of free agents is going to play with next year becomes more important than the games that are being played this year.
Very well said. Jim Gray, thank you very much.
Doug, thank you so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Jim Gray is an Emmy Award-winning sportscaster and the author of Talking to Goats. Find out more at WPR.org. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Melissa Mertz, Mark Oliver Everett, and Jim Gray. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast. It's available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
Thinking of holding on to the job for a while, it's like, you know, it's money in my pocket.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I gotta get going. Me and my loser friends, you know, we gotta go get Aerosmith tickets.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
Super dominant male in a 50s greaser uniform.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. And please take care and stay safe. I'm Doug Gordon.
You just gotta keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.